I said to her, look, I've got this contract for IKEA. And we were so excited about it. And then it wasn't that long after, things were in IKEA with my name on. And then there was a banner with my face on it. And people would say, I've just been to IKEA in Nottingham or Coventry or, I don't know, Bristol or Sydney even in Australia. And I've just seen your face.
Meet Sue Pryke, an award-winning ceramicist at the top of her game with more than 20 years of ceramics design under her belt. Sue still has so much passion and excitement about her craft and business, which is a joy and an inspiration to see. In this episode, we talked about Sue's story, the importance of teaching creativity to kids, collaborating with chefs, what it's like to see your face in IKEA, and the power of the Great British Pottery Throwdown, on which Sue was actually a judge. Enjoy. Welcome to Creative Slurp Podcast, giving you the juice to build a successful creative business with me, Victoria Brown, a creative business advisor, former jeweller and craft fanatic. Now you're in the right place if you want to find real talk, inspiration and the best tips and strategies for your handmade business without the overwhelm. We're all about making business exciting and fun. Now buckle up and let's get started. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Sue. You were on my wish list for ages, so I'm really pleased that you've made it. I love your work. It's so simple, deceptively so, I feel. It just makes you feel really calm looking at it. But for anybody that doesn't know you, can you tell us a little bit about you and what you do?
So I'm Pryke, and I would say I'm a slip caster, which essentially I work with ceramics, but I work with liquid clay. So rather than sitting on a wheel and throwing pots that way, I work. So it's more of an industrial practice. So I work with liquid clay. So essentially you take the same clay that a thrower would use, but you add water to it. And also sodium silicates to it, which help the particles suspend. I know that sounds really technical, but you get this really lovely creamy mix of clay, and then you pour it into plaster molds. And so the porosity of the molds draws the moisture out of the clay. And then, yeah, it's a bit like making Easter eggs. Think of an Easter egg and you've got a hollow shell. Well, that's the way that I make pots. So that's why it's sort of an industrial practice, because you can work with one mold, or I can work with 50 molds. I mean, factories have hundreds of them, and then you fill them all up to the top, and then you empty them, and then you're left with the shell of a piece. I really, really enjoy it, because you can just, I like multiples. So you can create the same shape over and over again, and they're exactly the same. I mean, there are nuances, and we have to hand finish everything. I just think it's just a lovely process. It's just working with liquid silk. It's beautiful.
Lovely description. So did you always work with ceramics in that way, or has your style changed over the years?
I've worked this way for a long, long time. I mean, when I first stumbled across ceramics, then I took the same route that everybody does, which is throwing, which is the way that people understand, you know, that's what you think of, isn't it, when you think of ceramics. So I sort of learned how to throw and hand build at college. And then it wasn't until I got to a degree course that I found slip casting and plaster work, which is sort of, they go in hand in hand, sort of model making. That was like 1990. So I've pretty much stuck to that since 1990. So that's a long time. It's a long time to be doing one thing. I mean, I have done other things in between, not necessarily, you know, practical ceramics. I've designed ceramics or taught ceramics, but it's essentially, yeah, along the same path.
So how do you think you've kept your business fresh, even though you've been doing the same thing? Because you still seem really enthusiastic about it, even though you've been doing it since 1990.
Yeah, I think clay's a drug, don't you? I think sort of once it's got you in its clutches, that's it. So I think that's why people, you know, stay enthusiastic, because I mean, there's still loads about slip casting that I just don't get. I just don't understand. You open the kiln and it's like, what happened there? No idea. So there's still things that happen. Talk to any potter, they'll say exactly the same. You know, when you open that kiln, it's like Christmas morning. It's like the excitement is still there, because you always got your fingers crossed hoping that it works. I mean, more or less it does work every time, but sometimes you get little things that happen. But I guess in terms of freshness, then I have worked in different ways with slip casting. I mean, at the minute, for the last sort of perhaps 10 years, I've been working with a coloured porcelain bodies, which is like sort of working with, I don't know if you know jasperware, which is the Wedgwood coloured body. They tend to sort of work with decorative pieces with that colored clay. You know, they put the white motifs on it for decoration. I mean, I've taken all of that detail off, but I do work with that colored body and keep the outside raw and unglazed. So you've got a mixture of a matte outside, which we polish to make it sort of pebbly smooth, but have a glossy glaze in the middle. You know, so the plate is glossy on the face and raw, you know, sort of matte underneath. So you've got that, you know, you've got that contrast there. So, but I haven't always worked that way. I've always slip cast, but yeah, just make it in different ways. I used to work with lots of coloured glazes years ago. So, and form changes all the time as well. I mean, although the forms are very sort of pared back, I think as I get older, I take detail away rather than adding any embellishments, you know, anything on there that doesn't need to be there, like a handle on a jug, you know, get rid of it, take it away, pare it back and just keep it very simple.
That's really interesting. Why do you think that you end up taking stuff away?
Yeah, you'd think as I got older, I'd pile it all on. I don't know. Well, I suppose if I were to reflect, then I suppose one of my first jobs when I started working with clay was at Wedgwood. So that was like 1991. I was a designer at Wedgwood. So I kind of had that exposure to industry, but also traditional ceramics. And obviously at Wedgwood, it was all about embellishment. It wasn't just about pure form. And I think I really, really thoroughly enjoyed that experience. And I've taken sort of a lot from it. But at the same time, I was a shape designer at Wedgwood. I was never a pattern designer. And every job that I've done in industry as a designer, it's as a shape designer. So I do the shapes. I don't do the pattern. I'm not very good with pattern. So that's one thing that I really love, form. And to be able to sort of develop a shape, you look at the silhouette of it or you look at the function of it, you don't look at the pattern. So if a shape can still sort of operate and function and look, you know, aesthetically pleasing, then you can take the unnecessary detail away. So, you know, Wedgwood was my starting point, but I've worked for IKEA as a designer for 20 odd years as well. So maybe that sort of Scandinavian aesthetic has rubbed off as well, I think.
That's really interesting. You can see that you're into shape because the shapes that you create are so simple and so beautiful at the same time. And it's interesting to see what you say about, you know, as you get experience, you start taking things away, because I found a similar thing as a writer. You know, when you start out, you add loads in. And I think then I got really good at taking stuff out the longer I went on and simplifying it. So maybe that's a sign of experience.
So, yeah, absolutely. I think it's confidence, isn't it? You know, you're confident enough to not need that extra word or that description. Or for me, you know, I don't need that handle. That's a confidence. And I think many people would look at me and say, well, where's the handle on that jug? It's like, well, you don't need it. It's small enough that it sits beautifully in your hand. It feels nice to hold. So I think it's a confidence to be able to do that. So maybe that comes with maturity and experience.
Yeah. And do you think that in terms of shapes, do you think trends inform those shapes and the way people live? Because obviously the way people live changes gradually as time goes on. Do you think that that influences your work as well?
It does. But I mean, when I worked in industry as a designer, sort of working in house in particular, you'd research trends. You'd go to the trade fairs and you'd look to see what was new. You'd go to sort of WGSN, you know, you go to the trend houses and find out, you know, what was going to be on trend for the next 3 years. I mean, I don't do that, but what I am very aware of is how people eat differently. I mean, it used to be, again, going back to Wedgwood, plates were 10 inches across or 26 centimetres, and they'd all sort of have a border around them. And there's a couple of reasons for that. I mean, one of them, especially for a factory like Wedgwood, is that you can decorate that bit and you'd have sort of like your decorative border detail, but also, you know, you'd frame your food, so, you know, you have the food in the middle bit and then the border, not necessarily decorated, would sort of frame your food. But we don't eat in the same way, we don't eat so formally anymore. If, for instance, you're having, say, spaghetti bolognese tonight, would you have it on a plate like that? Probably not. You'd probably find a nice bowl, wouldn't you, you know, something deep. Or if you're having noodles or pasta or rice or couscous. Things have changed. The way that we eat has changed. The way that we approach food is very different than in the past. I mean, I know when I was growing up, I don't think I had rice, pasta or couscous until I went to university. You know, we didn't have a curry or a Chinese, but, you know, there was lots of foods that I didn't have growing up. So things have changed a lot. I mean, I know I'm, you know, 50 odd now, but things have changed in those 30 years. and they're changing all the time. So that also informs what tableware design needs to be like and how it needs to perform, because, you know, we're all exposed to these interesting foods and trends within food. So tableware needs to be reflecting exactly that. Yeah.
So what inspires your work, would you say? Is it mainly the way people live, or are there other factors as well?
I think there's so many things. I mean, I think landscape and, you know, the colour of the dramatic landscape, perhaps that informs sort of the colours that I use, but also sort of the look and feel of something. I always say that I grew up in Lincolnshire, which is like a very flat landscape. Part of Lincolnshire that I grew up in is called South Holland. It's very, very flat. So massive skies, really dramatic. Rows and rows of tulips, because it is South Holland after all. You know, tulip fields were full this time of year of tulips, and earlier in the year daffodils. So I think that sort of regimented rows and rows of things exactly the same has sort of informed what I do. And I think that's always inspired me. But now, I mean, inspiration can come from 17th century creamware. It can come from sort of modern, you know, modernist design. It can come from just having a walk. You know, it comes from a multitude of different areas. So I can't actually say there's one particular thing that, you know, I can pinpoint as inspiration. But I think I've always been inspired by tableware and what that looks like. And they used to call them foliated terminals, you know, a handle that at the bottom of it has a leaf on it. But, you know, how can you do that in a modern way? Well, you can take the foliage off to start with and maybe just sort of modernise the curve slightly on the handle so it's not quite so frou-frou. So there's little tweaks that you can do. Again, it's going back to sort of paring back detail, isn't it? So inspired by old and new, really, everything around you. Yeah.
So you've been going in business quite a while now, and you've been really successful, which I think is so many people's dream when they start out as a creative business owner, because not everybody makes it for that long. What do you wish you'd have known before you started your own business?
Oh, no, that's broad. So many. I wish I'd had sort of more, maybe sort of glaze technology or sort of understanding of clay's molecular makeup to start with, because then that would have I'd have a better understanding of what happens when things go wrong. I mean, that's sort of on a very sort of functional basis, but I wish somebody had said perhaps ask more questions. I think I was a little bit too afraid to not know where I was going, or to ask questions, or not knowing who to ask. So I think there's just so many things, you know, you kind of find your way, don't you, and you explore and you learn by making mistakes. Yeah, so I think there's so many things that could have made life easier, but would it have been so interesting? Probably not. Maybe I wouldn't have been the same person if I'd been handed it all on a plate.
Yeah, interesting. So you started out at Wedgwood and decided to leave and start your own business. What prompted you deciding to do that?
So working back then in the 90s at Wedgwood, there wasn't any computers, everything was hand-drawn. So the process was that you'd design something, you talk to your manager, they say, we need to design this range. So you draw it and he'd say, great, that's fine. Go to the model makers now and go and make it. So you went up to the plaster studios where all the mold makers and the model makers worked. And at the time there were like over a dozen model makers. So they'd show you sort of how to make this piece in plaster. So you go back to the design studio with your plaster model, show it to your manager, and he'd go, oh, that's great. Just take a little bit off of here and there, and that'd be great. So you go back to the plaster studio, and then you'd have to remake it or turn it down and, you know, take that millimeter off or something. Then you go, and it was just going backs and forwards like this. It was very hand-eye coordinated, and in conjunction with what obviously your manager was thinking. And it was very hands-on. Things changed after that, and it became, you know, computers came in, but I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I really enjoyed the experience of working in the model making studio and working with those model makers who created things on a lathe or by hand, and I really enjoyed that aspect rather than sitting in the design studio. So I thought, I'm going to apply to go back to college, so I think I'll do an MA. So I applied to Stoke and I applied to the Royal College and got into both, and thought, well, which one do I do now? So anyway, I decided to go to the Royal College just because, I don't know, I suppose I'd lived in Stoke for a bit and enjoyed the industry thoroughly, but just thought I'll go to Stoke and go on to the next adventure. So that's one reason why I sort of left Wedgwood, and yeah, probably didn't look back really. In many ways, I think I perhaps should have stayed at Wedgwood a bit longer to have learnt more skills, but at the same time, there was other things clearly waiting for me. So, and it was amazing to be in London as a student. Yeah.
Do you think that having that previous experience in a slightly different department has really helped with your business now? Because if you'd just gone straight into making ceramics and Italian business, you wouldn't have learned all the other stuff that you'd learned.
Absolutely. And I think there's lots of things that I've picked up on the way. I mean, even one of the things, when I did my degree, it was a ceramics and glass degree, but it was designed for manufacturing. That was the title of it. And the course leader, he had written the course so that we as students came out as studio practitioners, but had an understanding of business as well. So there was a practical aspect in business attached to it. And I remember we had to write a business plan and present it to a bank manager as part of the course. Wow. I know. That was fantastic. And I remember one of the business guys that came in, he was running a bridal company, I think, and all of us sort of potters were like, what can he teach us? And I don't think we quite understood all of that. And probably we could have perhaps learned a lot more from him than we did. But I think that was one aspect of the course that was fantastic and prepared me for sort of graduating. But obviously I picked up lots, you know, just being in the studio as a designer and in the model making studio. And then I think after that, there's lots of things that I've picked up in different parts of jobs that I've done, like working in-house as a designer. One of the best bits of advice from that company was working with buyers and merchandisers and seeing what they do with product. You know, they're very business orientated and they need to make sure that that product drives sales or that product hits the margin. And if it doesn't hit that margin, then it's out. So I think there's lots of lessons like that that I've sort of picked up. I've probably not kept them all. Some of them I've discarded because I don't like them. For whatever reason. There's a lot that still sits at the back of my mind. And I think actually that, yeah, they did that for good reason. And I'm sure I could have learned far more on the way if I'd really listened. But sometimes you don't realise sort of the relevance, do you, as you're travelling through. So
good. And talking about that commerciality those merchandisers have, is that something you ever think about in your business, the commerciality of your product when you're actually producing it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some things in the range that are in there because I like them. There's some things that don't sit with the rest of the range. And everybody in the studio say, well, it doesn't really sit with that straight-sided cup, that little twirly thing that you've designed. It's like, I know. I quite like that. So there's some things that don't make sense quite. There's some things that don't earn as many pennies as they should do. But I'm well aware of what my key drivers are in there and which ones are the best sellers, which ones, you know, there's lots of things in the range that perhaps we've duplicated, which are loss leaders that shouldn't be in the range. But I quite like them to be in there. So I ignore all of those sensible bits of information sometimes just because I like it. I'm well aware that we've probably got too many bowls and they're all doing the same job. But yeah. And I think if somebody from industry and merchandiser came in, that, you know, some of those things would go. Pretty sure of that, but I quite like the mix. So I think, yeah, I'm always sort of battling with myself, really.
What would you say has been the biggest challenge in your journey so far?
Well, the last few years have been exciting, haven't they? And actually, I mean, lockdown was interesting in that we were all sort of bracing ourselves and, you know, holding tight, thinking this is going to be really, really rocky. But actually, it didn't turn out to be as bad as expected. I think we closed the studio as soon as sort of lockdown started, thinking, well, that's it, we better go home, folks. But then orders started to roll in online, so that was better than we thought. And I think that's pretty much been the story, that there's always going to be, you know, times when business isn't quite so buoyant, but we just batten down the hatches and just choose a slightly different tact. So at the minute, I think this year is going to be more difficult than lockdown, because it's not about people sitting at home on furlough that can spend money. People are so concerned about spending money that they're not going to do it. So, you know, why would you want to spend 35 quid on a mug? People aren't going to necessarily do that this year, I don't think. So, what else can we do? So I think we just sort of slightly sort of changed the business a little bit. We're going to be very cautious about how we spend money too. So, you know, we've probably been frivolous in the past with spending in certain directions, and like, we won't be doing that. So yeah, I think it's just sort of being a bit more cautious and ready for anything. I think that's what this year might be like.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I definitely think everybody's feeling it. And I don't think it's just product businesses. I think it's all kinds of businesses, business to businesses. I think just the mindset is that people don't want to spend. So yeah, that's wise, then, wise,
I mean,
word.
At the same time, I mean, people that have got money, and we're doing really well this year with people that are really keen to buy something that's, individual, I was going to say unique, but we're not exactly unique, but you know, it's handmade, it's crafted in the UK, you know, there's a story behind it. And as we're chatting, you know, you can see sort of how my range is sort of built, you know, where it's come from. There is sort of a provenance to it, like there is with everybody's story. And I think there are people out there that they've made money, they've got money, that some of the problems that we're going to go through this year won't affect everybody. And they're quite happy to sort of back a business like mine and say, well, I'm going to have that dinnerware set because this is the year to do it. So, you know, we are selling dinnerware sets to people that are, you know, that want 6, 10, 12 place settings. So yes, I need more of those, really.
Great. It just makes you realise, saying that, how important those stories are and that you're telling them. Because I think it's so easy when it's your story not to tell it because you know it, but you have to keep telling people. And that it's that story for a maker or for a small business that is what's going to help them stand out over anyone else.
Absolutely. We've all got a story. You know, there is a story there. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know that we necessarily shout about it. I mean, it probably is there bubbling along, but you're absolutely right. Maybe this is the time that we really need to be shouting about it and letting everybody know what we're doing and why we're doing it and how we're doing it. And we know from social media that people absolutely love to see a reel of how things are made. And one of my most successful reels is like three of us trying to make a huge bowl and getting the right pickle with it. People like to see that sort of bit of drama, don't they, and that jeopardy. That's why television programs like the Pottery Throwdown and Bake Off, you know, that's why they do so well, because people just love to see that. So that's something else that, you know, perhaps we should be better at. I know we do a bit of it, but you know, it's just staying on top of it all, isn't it, and keeping all these balls juggling in the air.
It is. Yeah. And I love, I have to say, talking about videos, I love that video on your website that I spotted that's got all the sound effects on. And if anyone hasn't seen it, they should go and watch it, because it's how the process of making, I think it's the mugs, isn't it, of how the mugs are made. And there's hardly any sound. It's just these sound effects of the processes. Yes. Yeah. And I just found it really relaxing. I just watched it. And I was like, oh, this is really soothing.
Yes, that's the one. Yeshen helped me to make that. So yeah, that was, you know, it's on my website, isn't it? Yes, it's the plonk plonk and the being mixed up and dropping into a bucket. And yeah,
it was so lovely. I'm a real audio person because I used to work in radio, so for me, like hearing all those sounds and someone thinking about the sounds when they're making a video was really lovely to see.
Yeah. And I think there should be a follow-up to that of, you know, making a cup of tea, you know, with a spoon.
Yes.
Stirring the tea around. The kettle boiling in the background to show the product in use.
People don't use sound enough, so they definitely should. They're quite evocative. Yeah. So you talked about the Pottery Throwdown, of course, that being massive. How has that affected the industry, do you think?
Oh, massively. Oh, the Throwdown is such a fabulous programme. It's so good. It's so positive. And I think it's showing the public that pottery is not easy. It's not straightforward. I mean, Keith and Rich make it just look a breeze, don't they? But it's really difficult. And you have to sort of practice and practice and practice. You've got to get those 10,000 hours in to actually produce, you know, quality work. And I think the show shows the potters, you know, in that struggle, trying to sort of manage like a big bag of clay on the wheel, or trying to model a figure or an animal or something. They show sort of the problems that they encounter, and it's done loads for the industry. I mean, if you think that actually there's only 2 full-time just specialist ceramic degree courses left now, Cardiff and Central St Martins, there is still ceramics in higher education, but they're not the specialist single honours courses that they used to be. And obviously there isn't so much in schools anymore either. So, you know, at what point are we going to be exposed to pottery and, you know, and ceramics broadly? You know, we're not necessarily our kids aren't going to necessarily pick it up in school anymore. So the television gets into, I don't know what the viewership is now, but it, you know, it's 6-10 million probably, you know, homes every week when that's on, which is fantastic. And it's seen in such a positive light. So it's done loads for the industry. Fantastic programme.
And I can imagine it's brought people in, but it's also made people appreciate ceramics all the more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all the hard work that goes into it, you can see that it's not that easy. So, yeah, absolutely. I think anybody that's considering, you know, whether 30, 35 quid is worth it for a price of a handmade mug, will look at that programme and go, oh, yeah, I can see now. I can see what it's all about. So absolutely. It's done loads for the craft, not just the pottery industry, but yeah, craft in general. there's lots of other programs too now about craft, isn't there? So I think we all like to see how things are made, and it's gonna help the industry generally.
Yeah, I do feel really worried about schools. My son's quite young and they're just starting school now. And the lack of creativity and stuff they do in school around creativity is astonishing. Because Cinderella, it's not just about people who go into a craft industry, it's about building that creative brain. And I just think it's so important. And my first son is particularly very creative. So I really try and give them creative time at home because I just think it's so important.
Absolutely. And I mean, I always say that when you look around you, every single thing that you see around the home or, you know, car or whatever, has been designed by somebody. Somebody has sat down and thought about that and designed it. So, you know, we do need a good, thriving creative industry. And that stems from good education at school. You know, how else are people going to know about it and understand it and love it? So it's so important. Yeah,
I think it's sadly becoming like music and performance, where if you want to do it, you have to do it outside of school and you have to pay for lessons or whatever.
But that's terrible as well, isn't it?
I know.
Listen to music in one form or another, even in the supermarkets there, isn't it? But, you know, we all listen to music, whether it's on the, you know, in a drama on the TV or on the radio. We're all aware of it, aren't we? So, yeah, it's just daft that it's just not a bigger part of our curriculum.
Yeah, it's not appreciated. You have collaborated with your husband on some work as well. So what's it like working with your husband within your business?
Interestingly, he sort of had a change of direction about 10, 12 years ago. And he said, I'm just going to start something in a slightly different direction. So he started this company called Wild and Wood. And the words were all sort of a play on sort of what his surname is, but also he wanted to do something that was about craft, but also about sort of living and working in the woods and survival. He'd been on a trek to the Arctic with Ray Mears just a year or so before that. And he did sort of mad survival course.
Wow.
And they learned how to sort of survive and make homes, but also carve things. And he was just so inspired by that. So he started this company. It was kind of outdoor, but about sort of carving materials, carving spoons and making chairs and tables and things. And people had always said to us, I don't know why you two don't work with each other. And I just said, he's so annoying, I can't work with him. He doesn't say about me. Anyway, we just thought, should we just collaborate on one or two things? So I'd been working in-house and I just thought, I'm going to go back to making. So my idea was, I'll get a bone china factory to make some pieces for me. I'll get a terracotta factory to make some pieces. I'll go and see a pewter factory. Now, who could I get to make some wooden things for me? And my husband said, well, I could just turn you those on the lathe. Oh, yeah, of course you can. So then this sort of idea of this collection, our Mr. and Mrs. collection, sort of came to fruition. So I made some ceramic pieces and he made the lids that went on top and the teapot, which is still in the range. It's pretty much the only thing left now from the original shapes. And then the wooden handle. So he steam bends those handles in oak, and the wooden top on top of the teapot, he turns those on the lathe. So there's still sort of some remnants. And he was doing chopping boards and platters and trays for me as well. So yeah, so we started working together. And we kind of drifted away slightly now, but we still work together and we do the trade fairs together and craft fairs together. But our products have kind of just taken on a slightly different direction now. John's, I know this sounds really weird, but John's found concrete. It doesn't sound very, very natural, but actually it's a zero carbon, a green sort of concrete that he's found. So very similar to ceramic. It's got very similar qualities, kind of quite smooth because it's cast in a mold. It looks very similar, and people get really confused at trade fairs because he very often uses the same molds as mine. So he's doing vases that are the same shape as mine. It's like, which one's the concrete one and which one's the ceramic one? It's like matte and it looks very stone like, which is similar to some of mine. So we sort of rub along quite nicely.
Yeah. How funny that he ended up doing a similar kind of products to you but using a different material. Do you think he was inspired by you?
I think so. I think we've inspired each other. Yeah, I think there's lots that we've picked up, and I think that collection and that collaboration, I think, has become richer because we're sort of feeding off each other, you know, all the time. And that's what good partnership should be, I think. You know, you learn from each other. Yeah, and we've been together for so long anyway that we've probably become the same person.
What's been the most rewarding part of your journey so far, Sue? You must have had so many highlights in your career now.
Oh, there's lots of things that I've done that I just think, oh, that is so exciting. And I remember the first time that I had a contract from IKEA, and my studio at the time was in London, in Farringdon, Clerkenwell. And I showed my friend Claire Goddard, she's, I don't know if you know her, she's a textiles lady. I said to her, look, I've got this contract for IKEA, and we were so excited about it. And then it wasn't that long after that things were in IKEA with my name on, and then there was a banner with my face on it. And people would say, I've just been to IKEA in Nottingham or Coventry or, I don't know, Bristol or Sydney even in Australia, and I've just seen your face. My cousin that lives in Australia just rang me and said, I've just seen you in IKEA. So I think that was an early boost. And I think I realised at the time the gravity of that is that IKEA is absolutely huge and their production is enormous. And that first range, the 365 plus range, was one of the biggest selling tableware ranges in the world. And it probably still is because it's still in production. Massive. I mean, you think of how many lives, how many people have actually eaten off of that shape, that range. It's incredible.
So wow.
I don't think you can get much bigger than that in terms of production volume and sort of world coverage. That's pretty special.
Yeah. And impact on people's lives.
Yeah, and I think that that's sort of one of the biggies in that it's so exciting to see that people are using something that you've made. Or I mean, in terms of IKEA, it's something that I've designed, but you know, even now, things that we make, people are using them, and people come back or put on the reviews on the website saying how fabulous it is and what difference it's made to their lives. You think, well, that's great, because that's exactly the feedback that you want to hear, isn't it? That actually somebody's, they've felt so special about that. There's a connection, there's a connection with the material and the design and the shape and the maker. I think that's just so nice. Yeah.
Mm. Is there anyone that you would still love to collaborate with or love to work in partnership with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't sort of name one single person, but I'm just thinking of other collaborations. I once collaborated with Janice Chalenko. I don't know if you know her, but she was somebody that inspired me when I first started with ceramics. I mean, she was my mum's age, and I always knew about her. Because she was one of those potters in the 70s that wasn't producing brown thrown pots, you know, that were wood-fired or ash glazes. She was experimenting with colour, so lots of brightly coloured daubs of paint and patterned, very floral sort of patterns on her pieces. She had a collaboration with Dark Pottery in Devon, sort of way back in the 70s. And I just thought that was just lovely. And so because she was like a studio potter but collaborating with industry, that really inspired me to do what I'm doing now. And I got to know Janice because she was one of my tutors when I was at the Royal College. And then a few years after I left, we collaborated together to do a collection. So we had shapes made in industry by Hornsey Pottery, some vases and some bowls. I did all the shapes and she did the patterns. So I just thought that was just so lovely. So that's, you know, that, I mean, there's so many people that I would love to collaborate with. I couldn't actually name who, but that was a really special story working with Janice in that way.
Working with your heroes.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, yeah, when did you get the chance to do that? And I never thought that would happen either. That was just remarkable.
I think it probably helps that you're really clear on what your strength is, that it's shapes, and you know that it's shapes. So then you can work with someone whose strength is something else to maybe kind of cover a different angle.
Yes, and I think now, actually, just thinking of collaborations, it tends to be, the collaborations that I'm having now tend to be with chefs. So there's a special chef who is absolutely amazing called Kirk Howarth. He's based in East London. His company's called Plates. He's a plant-based chef. And I can't quite remember how we sort of met each other. So he'll create something and he'll say, oh, I need a bowl for that. Or I need a plate that's got to kind of look organic, but it's got to look crisp and clean at the same time. So we tend to do quite a few. I mean, he works with not just one ceramicist, not just me, but lots of people. That's a really nice collaboration, you know, to see, look him up on Instagram and you'll see that it's my shapes that he's using, sort of white, creamy pieces. They're slightly organic, but his food is just absolutely amazing. It's the best food I've ever tasted. And it's all plant-based, amazing. And he's doing it because I think it's Lyme's disease that he's got. So I think he's gone through periods of time where, you know, he's completely debilitated and can't sort of function. And he's found that food is the best medicine. You can't nourish your body with drugs, but you can with food. So he knows that medicinal food is going to be far better, or pure, clean, fresh, plant-based food is far better for him than getting prescription from the doctor. So amazing.
Oh, I guess having beautiful tableware is part of that experience and making you feel even better when you're eating it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because there's a tactility to it and there's sort of a visual sensation to it, visual connection to it. So yeah, they sort of go hand in hand. Until relatively recently, hotels would have gone to sort of the main source, which would have been the big sort of hospitality companies, the big manufacturers making hotelware for restaurants, which is hard and durable, and you know, longevity is associated with that as well, so that chefs can always replace the same things. And I think things have become far more relaxed and far more interesting, and there's loads of potters that are making for restaurants now. So you know, and very creative, and stuff that you just look at and you go, no way is that being used in a restaurant. But that's because the chefs are, you know, being just as creative with their tableware as they are their food. So it's an amazing industry, I think, at the minute. It's vibrant, buoyant and exciting.
Interesting to know that yeah, when I say collaborations, I thought of the makers. So to think of chefs, of course, creative, are collaborating with you. That's just a different angle, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's so many potentials there.
So you talked about health just. When you're a business owner, I think it's quite stressful, because especially if you are in charge of the business, because you are running everything yourself and you have to stay motivated. How do you deal with that stress and how do you keep yourself well?
Well, one thing that I've recently started to do, I've been going to a sewing class.
Oh, wow.
My daughters, they bought me a dressmaking course a few years ago, and I did dressmaking at school because we all did needlework and, you know, made dresses and lots of items of clothing. And I've always liked a bit of sewing. My mum used to make all of our clothes. I think on that era where your mum did, everything was knitted or handmade. And anyway, my daughter's bought me this dressmaking course for my 50th a few years ago. And I made a few things. And then I just got really busy and put it all down and didn't even finish things. And so they've obviously thought, mum needs to go back to sewing. So for Christmas this year, they bought me another sewing course. So you just go along with your patterns and your material, and there's a tutor there to help you. So it's a 5-week course, and I've made about 5 garments now. So one a week, pretty much. So I've thoroughly enjoyed that. So that's exciting. Now I'm thinking, what can I do with that? It's going to be a collection next year, isn't it? Ceramics and clothing. So there's that one. Because I don't really sort of switch off and relax. And I find that Monday morning class, I have to do it because I've been booked into it. And I've told everybody at work I'm not in on a Monday morning because I'm going sewing. So that's one thing that's nothing to do with business. But apart from that, I think it's just fresh air and walking. I walk every day because I've got 2 dogs. And I run, but I don't run as much as I used to. But I think it's just that exercise sort of lights up the brain, doesn't it? And I think it's that, it's sort of a creativity booster. That's sort of when you're walking down the, you know, across the fields and you're not really thinking, you're just taking it all in. And I mean, this morning, just looking at all the blossom that's just starting to come out and looking at the leaves unfurling on the tree and just looking at the beech leaves this morning, actually, just how they're just like a, you know, really nice bit of folded Izumiaki fabric. I'm sure you're inspired by, you know, unfurling leaves. So it's just so inspirational. And I think it's just time for me to sort of clock off and just think about other things or just let things filter. It's that time of day. So, but I do yoga, and there's also another practice that there's a couple of other things that I do on Instagram, which I started doing because I heard about it through Sarah James from Craft Festival, heard about it during lockdown, and it's Qigong by Mark Shaler, 8 o'clock in the morning. It used to be every morning during lockdown, and also breath work with Matt Bagwell. And both of those things I've kind of stuck to. I mean, neither of them do it every day anymore, but they've built up such a lovely community that I didn't know what breath work was or what Qigong was until lockdown. And it's just another sort of half an hour or an hour to set aside for yourself, sort of self-love, self-care. So yeah, there's a few more sort of spiritual things I think I've given myself time for than I've ever done before.
Yeah, sounds great. I'm jealous about the sewing because that's on my list for this year. And I actually don't think it's going to happen, but it is on my list.
Yeah, do it. You've just got to block it. Just block book it. And then you can't get away from it. You've got to do it. But yeah, it's lovely. It's so rewarding because it's like, well, what have you made today? Oh, I made a fisherman's jacket today. Look, it's got pockets in. Oh, I've made a dress with some really nice fabrics, Japanese fabric from Merchant and Mills. You know, it's just amazing. So rewarding. Do it.
Wow. I'm really inspired now. One garment a week is a high bar, though.
Yeah, I know. The idea is, though, I mean, just choose an easy pattern.
Yeah. Well, that's my plan. Choose a pattern I love and then just replicate it lots of times in different fabrics so Absolutely. That I've got a yeah. whole wardrobe.
Yeah, long sleeves, short sleeves, no sleeves. That's it.
We'll just get a sack and type a hole in it and there we go. That'd be easy. Yeah, and I also did the Qigong with Mark, although I haven't been going very often. Yeah. Yeah, and it's been fantastic. It's just very hard now I've got school drop off to try and fit it.
Yeah, it was great during lockdown, wasn't it? I really loved lockdown because of that, because you had time to do the yoga and the running and all of it. There wasn't the same pressure. Now we seem to be back to normal, don't we? And
pressure
of doing every day.
Yeah, I work from home now, which gives me more flexibility than it did, but then I still have to make sure I carve the time out, and that sometimes is harder because you could sit there all day in your office, and I have to make myself have a walk, because like you say, that's when I get my ideas, my creativity. And I just went out for a 10-minute walk before this and I got about 3 ideas in my head, and it's bonkers.
Absolutely amazing. And it's quick, easy, and it's free.
Yes, exactly. It's long bath. Just hopefully it's not raining, although I've got a coat now with a big hood, so it's not so bad. So thank you so much for joining us today, Sue. What have you got coming up in your business at the moment?
So, I've written a book, actually. I wrote a book in lockdown with Linda Bloomfield.
Wow. So congratulations.
So it's called Design and Create Tableware. So it's a sort of a step-by-step guide. So that came out in February. And then Great Northern Contemporary Craft Fair later on in the year. And I've also applied for another couple of craft fairs. So, yeah, hopefully a few more craft fairs this year. It's nice to get out and about and meet people at these things. So, yeah, lots of craft fairs. And also, this is going into May. I've been in my new studio for a whole year now. So there's a couple of sort of late night shopping evenings coming up, and we're opening for sort of a whole, we don't normally sort of open the shop every day or every week, so there'll be some open shopping days. And also I'm running some slip casting courses too, so there's going to be at least 2, if not 3 or 4 this year. So yeah, the first one's in May, the second one's in July. Yeah, wow. There's lots going on.
Exciting, lots going on. How do people get in touch with you if they need to get in touch?
I'm on Instagram, just Sue Pryke. I'm Sue Pryke Studio on Facebook, website suepryke.com, and sign up to my newsletters through the website to hear more.
Thank you so much for listening to Creative Slurp. I hope it's inspired you to try something new in your business. If you loved it, please take the time to leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you soon, and go and chase your biggest creative business dreams. You can do it.